Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. It is my honor and pleasure to welcome to the program today retired United States Air Force General Dave Goldfein, the 21st Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force. He is now a board member of one of the world's leading investment firms, Blackstone, with some $1 trillion in assets under management. And he sits on the boards or advises numerous other firms from Anduril and Shield Capital and many others. Our monthly technology coverage is brought to you by Clarion Defense and their APEX conference next January here in Washington, D.C. We are pleased to be partnered with Clarion to highlight APEX and bring to you the types of conversations and issue coverage you can expect at the two-day event. And I should note that Clarion is a Blackstone company. Sir, it is an honor and pleasure welcoming you back to the program. Thanks so very much for joining us.
You had Vago. Thanks for having me.
So congratulations on the success you've had since you retired from the United States Air Force after decades of illustrious service. And one of the questions that I was interested in and I find is most intriguing when I talk to retired general officers, especially when they go into industry and especially to finance and on the investment side of things, they go, wow, you know, if I'd only known this while I was in uniform, what are some of the things that you know now that you wish you'd known when you were still in the Air Force, and especially when you were Chief of Staff of the Air Force?
You know, thanks. I used to host, I hosted a series of, you know, CEO dinners at the Air House. And I would always ask the CEOs, I said, you know, listen, I've never been in the profit and loss business. I want to be a really good customer. Tell me what's important to you as the CEO of your, you know, defense firm in terms of what I can do. And it was interesting. They said, you know, pretty consistently, they said, you know, we listen to what you say and we're a bit tired of making static displays, which is what happens when you tell us to go right and then you shift and go left. And we invest, you know, industry money on trying to solve your particular problems. So consistency in your message and helping us understand the problems is what you can do best. And now that I've been on the outside, And I've seen, you know, what it looks like from an industry perspective. Not only would I second that, but I'll tell you that while I watched my messaging very closely, the one thing now that I wish I had done is spend a little bit more time at the contracting officer level to ensure that the message that I was portraying was reflected in the actual contracts we were putting out, so that we were building the incentive structure for business to be able to do what I was asking them to do. Because what I've now seen on the outside is that the messages are still fairly clear, but the contracting mechanisms to get business to actually deliver are very challenging, very difficult, and in some ways very archaic.
You were a senior leader, and I think many senior leaders do try to invest that time to better understand their industry colleagues, right, by hosting dinners and the like. Do you think that there's something that needs to be injected in the education path for officers, especially those destined for more senior roles, whether it's at Capstone, to sort of broaden that aperture to have some of this? Right, because you have to take an interest to do it, and some folks are thrust into it and maybe don't take that interest as early as you did. Is there a way that the education process should be changed to improve it?
Yeah, I don't know necessarily changed, Vago. I will say that the more we can invest in our junior officers and NCOs to understand industry as our teammates on this journey, the better. So I'll share one story. You know, I went out in 2018, I think I went out to Hoover Institute, Silicon Valley, for a track two discussion with leaders there. And I was on a panel with the chief of policy from Google, Karan Bhatia. And he said, so what do you want out of this discussion? I said, well, you know, it's interesting. I'm the only service chief that can claim to be the leader of a garage startup. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, you got Larry and Sergey and I've got Orville and Wilbur, right? And the rest the rest is history, right? And I said, but the truth is, I'm also in charge of a hardware company, both culturally and physically, but my future is in software. Right. And the currency of future warfare is not platforms, sensors, and weapons, it's data. And I can't take my service where it needs to go without your help. And so we started what we called a prisoner exchange with a couple of the IT companies in Silicon Valley. And it was an exchange of young officers and cadets at the Air Force Academy, because we have the academy that's farthest west, to start building an understanding between, you know, a young tech workers that are working at Google and Apple and Microsoft and Amazon, and our young cyber warriors in the United States Air Force, and I would offer across the joint force, to be able to build common language, common understanding, and common and common recognition of the problem statement, so that we can work the solutions together, because that's the only way the solutions will come.
And that was a great line, by the way. You've got Orville and Wilbur, because they were right. I mean, bike mechanics that ended up changing humanity. There are those who, you know, this week our 2 days conference on AI in the memory of Dr. Ash Carter, who was one of the people who was driving this revolution when he took over in 2014 with his famous Drell lecture to sort of focus everybody's attention, launching DI, Defense Innovation Unit Experimental, that then became DIU. And you were there at the start of this, both as vice, but then when you were also chief. You know, there is a theater component to it, which some people say, hey, look, innovation theater is good because you engage and you harness more people. On the other hand, there are folks who say, look, I mean, this then muddies the waters. What you know, when you hear innovation, what is the kind of innovation that we need? Because, you know, not to sound like Don Rumsfeld, but eventually, right, the toilet becomes an innovation and, you know, a breakthrough. And it's like, okay, you know, maybe that's been carried too far. From your standpoint, where are the focus areas? What does this look like? What does it need to look like? And what do we need to do to get to where we need to be, as opposed to just thrashing a lot? Because for a while, there seems to be greater movement and heat than and smoke maybe than progress.
Yeah, so two stories to help answer. So first story, I was at I won't name the industry, but I was at a company headquarters, and I was being shown an entry into some rather exquisite new technology, airborne technology. And as I was walking around the big hangar and talking to the team, I said, so now you're also, you know, a company that we invest very heavily in space. So can you walk me through how this particular technology you're showing me in the hangar is connected, is sharing data, is working with all of the space architecture that's also, you know, within your company? And they said, well, Chief, that's a different part of the company. I said, okay, dígame, tell me, you're telling me that these two parts of the same company are not actually communicating and setting this up so that they are connecting on a common operating system, they're sharing data, that there's AI at the edge. That's not happening in these two domains in the same company. He says, no, not happening. I said, oh, well, I said, I need you to pay close attention. I'm no longer interested in what you're showing me in this hangar. And I won't be interested in purchasing this until you can show me how it connects, how it shares, and how it learns. And that's where that framework that we then started using for where we needed to take the Air Force for sure and the Department of Defense going forward. The challenges to achieve that are as culturally based as they are technically based. So today I'm, you know, one of the positions I'm privileged to hold is chairman of the board of Google Public Sector. I call it, you know, making a difference with people I like. And it's an ability to advance what I was passionate about on the inside, you know, for those who are now sweating in the arena. An advice that I got from Eric Schmidt when he was advising me on what became, you know, Joint All Domain Command and Control, he said, Dave, he goes, my advice to you is don't eat the entire elephant all at once. It will crush you with its weight. He said, and if you really want to kill it, he says, make it a program of record, you know, sort of tongue in cheek. And he said, if in industry, what we do is we just start solving problems by connecting things that aren't connected. And so we started down a path of, you know, aligning under a combatant commander And every 4 months or so, connecting systems that weren't previously connected, put them on a common operating system that they could share data that was not proprietary, and then moved AI in at the edge to get to better and faster decision making. And we made some pretty significant progress, for Stratcom, for Northcom, going forward. The question I think for us to think about is, how big an animal can we take on all at once? How do we ensure that the contracting mechanisms are profitable for industry so that they will be incentivized to give what the chiefs and the chairman are asking for? And how do we recognize that our procurement system is designed to have a destination where you have a thing at the end, a truck, an airplane, a ship? But this is an unending journey that in the IT world with data that never ends. Because as soon as you think you've close to arrived, the adversary changes their way of doing business and you've got to continue. So, I do believe that this journey that the department is on, that you and I talked about a lot, when I was in, I'm very proud of the, current leaders who can have continued to move it forward. This is a journey that will never end, but it's the most important journey the department is going to undertake.
Oftentimes, what you see in business, right? I mean, there's a profit motive, obviously, and then innovative companies have a very lean, light structure, right? So it's both top down and bottom up, where ideas can make it to the top so that folks go, hey, wait a minute, that's a solution to a problem I've got, and be able to move it. Whereas sometimes we find, right? I mean, the new organization of the Air Force that Secretary Kendall and Chief Alvin are engineering is to try to make this a little bit flatter and allow some of this stuff to percolate more easily, communicate, consolidate some features so that the requirements design is sort of done in one place, so it's not piecemeal. From your standpoint, what's the trick to getting this right in the Air Force? In harnessing cycles, right? I mean, Ukraine is showing us that it's as much about developing the new thing as it actually is spotting a solution that exists in commercial industry, adapting it, embracing it quickly, using it as long as it gives you advantage, then shifting to the next thing. What are some of the things we have to bear in mind? What does that design look like? What does the right structure from an Air Force standpoint look like, or a government standpoint look like for that matter?
One story that's I think is instructive, I like to I always used and still use, is the F-117 story and how that came to be, right? So as the last bandit who checked out in the airplane, I got to know the community pretty well and learn the story of Dennis Overholtzer, the engineer who in his spare time loved reading, foreign journals that had been translated into English, and he's reading a 10-year-old Russian paper. And in the paper, he finds the equation for stealth technology. And he goes back to his shed and he carves out what looks like a Hope Diamond and he brings it into Ben Rich, the CEO of Skunk Works. And he says, and he drops it on the desk. And Ben says, "What's that?" He said, "That is a shape that will return a radar return of an eagle's eye." And he said, "You mean an eagle?" He says, "No, an eagle's eye." And Ben looked at him and said, "Can you get it airborne?" "I'll give it a shot." And HAVBLUE was born. And they came to the Pentagon and with the Secretary of Defense and then Chief of Staff of the Air Force, Ben Rich pulled a marble out of his pocket and he rolled it across the table. And the secretary said, "What's that?" He goes, "That's the radar return of what I'm about to build you." So the moral of the story is this was not something the Defense Department asked for. This is something that industry produced. And the question for today, and the reason the story is so instructive, is could that marble today make it to a decision maker to get something to move as fast as we were able to move? That technology that became so important, that some say it was a significant part of the Cold War ending in our favor since the Soviet Union spent themselves into oblivion trying to counter it. So the marbles have got to be able to roll in a system that does not crush it, on its way to a decision maker. And so everything you mentioned about being flat in organizations, the best ideas are going to come from industry and from inside the services. And the question is, how do we get those marbles to the decision makers so we can move out?
Well, to that is how much of this is culture change? How much of this is organizational change? How much of this is process change? Because Ukraine is showing us that the nature that nobody is really has, like, advantage is not permanent, right? We as the US military have thought about advantage in decades, right? We'll have a decade's advantage. And we're seeing in Ukraine actually advantage is fleeting. The success goes to the person who can most quickly do that, right? Marble, adapt marble, operationalize marble. What are some of the things that have to happen across that arc to get us to where we need to be, considering that a lot of these, as you pointed out earlier, are going to be commercial innovations? The question is how quickly the military embraces these, looks at it, feels capability without regarding it as a 50-year thing. It may be useful for 2 years, 1 year, 3 weeks, right? As we see in Ukraine. What's the right approach across this ecosystem?
Well, first of all, I think we ought to recognize that we have done this before. If you look at the time of Schreiber and the Western missile, and what has happened there, if you look at the incredible acceleration that's going on with commercial space activity, if you look at some of the up and coming, defense firms that are, working to become primes but are not acting like primes, these are the Anduril, the Palantirs, these kinds of, disruptor kind of organizations, they're there. Part of what I think has to happen is a recognition that the pace of change that we're seeing in the world, is forcing us to be able to move at a faster clip. When I was chief, when we played various war games and various scenarios, the one that was the most challenging that I ever saw was, a Russia China alliance and a third party conflict that got us anchored in a way that, kept us from being able to focus on the broader horizon. If you take a look at what's going on right now in the world, and I was able to travel, was recently in Poland, Romania, Saudi Arabia, just came back from a dialogue in Hawaii. The world is a dangerous place, and the need for an acceleration to move the technologies that we need to stay ahead, those that we can conceal, and those that on a time and place of our choosing we can reveal, I think the time now is important. But the good news is we know how to do this because we've done it before. And I believe we've got the leadership in place now between what I've seen from the service secretaries and the service chiefs to be able to really advance the ball. And I know now from my time in industry that the motivations in industry are where they should be. They want to help solve our nation's biggest challenges.
The question is, what investment metric or scaffolding or framework is necessary at a time like this? You mentioned that when you were in uniform, you went into the hangar and they showed you something, and it like was like, okay, you already lost me, okay, in this pitch. And oftentimes, people have terrible ideas that pitch well, and other times brilliant ideas and don't pitch well. And even though with trillions of dollars in money sloshing around out there, not all, the best money always doesn't get connected with the best idea, despite good efforts by all. What is a metric, Dave, that you have? What is a good way of thinking about this? Because while everybody in Washington talks about Dr. Carter's great adage, "Hey, let's fail fast." The commercial industry fails a lot before it makes money on something. At the end of the day, right, the nightmare is getting called up in front of Congress and testifying before Chairman Reed and Ranking Member Wicker and getting the stuffing beat out of you. I remember you had some of those moments with the late, great John McCain, right? So what's a good framework to try to use about, you know, that could help simplify people's lives in terms of an approach on what to invest in and what not and how to do it?
You know, I'm not sure.
Including harnessing industry to help you solve your problem, right? Because you've got a lot of ideas and money and a lot, you know, that can help your customer ultimately.
Well, you know, I'm not sure who coined this phrase, but I remember hearing, you know, the only legal performance enhancing drug is trust. And if the department is going to move forward, and I can't tell you the amount of time spent building trust among the services, to ensure that not at the service chief level, but, you know, a couple levels below that, you know, we weren't doing the sort of typical bureaucratic, you know, build a castle, dig a moat and fill it with dragons to defend yourself, as opposed to, all right, we have got to find, you know, if connect, share and learn is the framework, we've got to, each service has got to work together towards each other in a common operating system. Each service has got to work and incentivize industry to ensure industry can no longer make data proprietary and unshareable, not only among various companies, but also amongst allies and partners. And we've got to build trust so that as we learn more and more about generative AI, large language models, and the technology that's already here and it's coming at an exponential rate, we've got to have the trust amongst the services that does not do, you know, the typical, you know, bureaucratic, you know, my way first, right? Each right. service has invested billions of dollars in command and control. I mean, think about it. Right. If you're a carrier strike group commander, you know, you've got to connect in all domains and being able to operate, you know, at sea. I mean, the Navy for me has always been the gold standard for mission command because they spend so much time, you know, not being able to check in with mom or dad, right?
Right.
So how do we build the trust among the services so that we can advance in a common way towards this network, this battlefield network that is going to provide not only better situational awareness, but better decision capability for future leaders. And I go back to my thought that data is the currency of future warfare. Most of us all grew up and the currency of warfare was platforms, sensors, and weapons. Our entire acquisition system is designed to have something that you can choke at the end, a platform, a sensor, or a weapon. But data is the currency of future warfare. Software is the essence of future warfare. And connecting and sharing and learning, our ability to do that will be based on whether we can build trust. Without trust, we'll pay lip service to it. We won't advance it.
But you were somebody who has been a joint all demand command and control visionary. You came into the role with the vision. There are many others who have been theorizing about this for a long time, and you've played into that throughout your career as well, right? General Deptula was talking about some of these ideas many, many years before on how to do it. But each of the services have their way of doing things. And it's sort of like, hey, we're going to do our thing and we'll connect it if we can. There looks like actually there's been an enormous amount of progress on sort of two tracks, the services working ad hoc with one another, and then the official Pentagon track, which is sort of, I would say, track two, unfortunately, rather than track one. How much of this, and magnifying this past, sir, just looking at JADC2, how much of this is actually not reinventing the wheel within the boundaries of your own service, but actually going, hey, that's a great idea, let's just adopt it, as opposed to, ooh, great idea, Goldfein. Now I'm going to go through the whole process of replicating that wheel on my own so that it's my special cherished wheel that will come in my color of choice as opposed to purple.
Well, part of this, I think, is understanding that each service has a different, that operates in different domains by design, has a different fundamental requirement for connecting its force and digitizing its force. And I had one of my most instructive conversations as I was trying to advance this joint all domain command and control was with Chief of Staff of the Army, who sat down with me and said, "Listen, Dave," he goes, "you're trying to build a system that connects 5,000 airplanes and operates at 300 to 500 knots. I'm trying to I have to connect 1 million soldiers that operate at 50 to 100 knots." I said we have a different demand that we have to digitize our force. So from that very instructive conversation, and I spent a lot of time with my service chief counterparts trying to truly understand what it is that they need. And I came to the conclusion that technology will allow an umbrella approach, meaning I do believe that the investment the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard, our allies and partners, I do believe that the fundamental investment each has made in their C2 can be preserved. And it can then also be connected with an umbrella approach. Man, that sounds,
Right.
that sounds easy. It's anything but. Because in that umbrella approach, right, you've got to go back to the fundamentals. What's the common operating system? What's the system of data sharing that's not proprietary? How are we going to continue to push artificial intelligence at the edge of our various systems? And so I go back to, an approach that we tried, again, back to the Eric Schmidt, don't eat the elephant, is, keep working on connecting systems through that framework across the services and with our allies and partners to solve specific problems. We did this at one particular, I remember we did an exercise for Stratcom, and the team came back and said, and showed me all of the data and said, "Sir, we were 87% successful." And I said, "That means we didn't try anywhere near hard enough. I'm not looking for 87% success, right? I'm looking for, more in like the 50 to 60% success because we are trying and we're leaning forward. And this is hard, right? And it's a journey that will never end. We're in this for life, as is our adversaries." And so, I do believe it will come down to, it still comes down to trust. And it comes down to senior leaders at the very senior levels, busting through those, castles, moats, and dragons and say, "We have got to do this together, right? If we're gonna maintain our advantage against the adversaries in this increasingly dangerous world, we have to do this together."
Are there things we should be learning from our adversaries that we're not right? We as Americans have a tendency of saying we're the best, and in many respects, we are the best. But it's only been until recently that we have been subjected to some surprises from our adversaries, whether it's China or Russia, in terms of capabilities that they're able to field. I mean, the Russians are being very adept at using, the information sphere to disinform and divide societies, right? And American society is no different. What are some of the things we should be learning from our adversaries, do you think? Especially when they, right? I mean, no idea is too good to steal, I suppose.
One of the things I've spent a lot of time on since retiring in this chapter is spending more time trying to see the world through someone else's lens. And that is completely different than seeing someone else through our lens. Because if we're truly going to understand what deters, what incentivizes, what drives the behavior we're looking for, you can only do that if you start by understanding what the world looks like through their eyes. And this really sort of came through me loud and clear, having spent, a good chunk of my adult life fighting in the Middle East and watching Afghanistan fall in 11 days. it causes you to step back and question, okay, what did we miss? Did we truly under do we ever truly understand what the world looked like through an Afghan lens? Do we understand today what the world looks like through a Chinese lens? I was privileged to travel for the first time to Beijing and spent a week at Tsinghua University there with Ambassador Carl Eikenberry, and got to lecture students and spend time with students from all across the world. And it was just fascinating for me to be able to listen to the way they see America and they see the world through their culture, through their history, and through their lens. With armed with that understanding, we'll be far more effective in terms of our strategies, in terms of finding areas to collaborate, even though we are in absolute competition and in some areas adversarial. The example I always think about is, think about it, since Russia invaded Crimea, we haven't had much diplomatic dialogue with them. But yet the entire time we've been living together in the International Space Station without a break. So one could argue we found a way to collaborate above the atmosphere, even though we disagree with everything below. Such is the nature of really complex international relations. And so that's where I think we always have to start. Do we understand the world through a Chinese lens? Do we understand the world through a Russian lens? If we do, then we're going to be far more effective in the strategies we build.
It was interesting that when the Air Force announced the Collaborative Combat Aircraft winners, historically, right, the assumption is it will be Boeing, Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, one of those. And the winners the Air Force announced were General Atomics, Aeronautical Systems, as well as Anduril. And one of the issues was, as you were saying, the openness on data rights. The customer want, you know, is saying, hey, we're investing, we're developing the system, we want access to the data. And unfortunately, time and again, we've seen competitions actually break down over leading companies that don't want to part with the data at the end of the day. What is the message that this award, Dave, do you think sent everybody? Because it is a message. And I thought it was particularly interesting that Sierra Nevada beat Boeing to develop the next Doomsday aircraft, right? $13 billion award. And that's just terrific for Fatih and Aaron Osman, who have built just a terrific company at the end of the day, not slighting any of the big primes here. But I mean, is there a message there, especially, for you who's sitting on a side of the business to try to grow those next, big competitors of the future?
Well, I'll tell you, as chief, one of my lessons as I was a few years into it and looking at all the various programs we were managing, without exception, my best programs was where there was the stiffest competition, and my worst managed programs were where there was little or no competition. And what I found as a chief, and now understanding a little bit more the pressures under the CEOs and the management teams in industry, I understand better how when you have a competitor that is, an alligator circling your boat, it makes you better. It makes industry better. And so I think part of the message that came out of the recent, combat air, CCA announcement was sort of a wake-up call to the defense industry in general that says there's some new competitors here. And these competitors are working to become primes, but not act like primes. And I think that's a good thing. And I say this, by the way, having felt then and now that, the big primes, the defense primes, were my teammates, right? They, we had to work together, as had chiefs and industry CEOs throughout history, back to this 117 and others like that. You have to have a partnership to be able to move forward, but there also has to be the mechanism, the contractual mechanisms to drive the behavior the department is looking for. And I think another message that came out of the CCA announcement was the department did a nice job of putting the right incentives on the table.
Right.
And so where this goes, anyone knows, but I'm really proud of the folks, the General Atomics and the Anduril and the Palantirs and the other ones that are out there that are swinging away and bringing capability fast because that's what the nation needs.
And to the question though that some asked, and I should have mentioned, and I think I did, that you've advised Anduril as well. How do you get them across the Valley of Death, sir? Right? Because that then becomes the question. There are a lot of folks who've got great ideas and try to make this step. Obviously, if Anduril ends up winning a meaningful award, that's going to be terrific. And the company certainly has a capability of raising money. General Atomics has invested a lot of its own money in order to be able to bring capability forward. And so you did send a signal more broadly, but how do you usher these companies to the point where they're big and self-sustaining, as opposed to just have, hey, they have a handful of boutique awards. Yeah, it's really great. They made 500 CCAs, but then they went the way of the dodo. Like, is there a more sustained approach we need to take some of these companies that are, really breakthrough in the engineering and the capability that they're bringing, but then make sure that they actually get to that next level where they're more sustained long-term competitors on the landscape?
Well, I think that, quite frankly, the onus is more on industry leaders on the answer to this question. So I'm going back to those Airhouse dinners I had. And we were doing those in very small groups, socially distanced through COVID, because I wanted to keep this dialogue going. And one of the things that was interesting to me during these dinners was, I'm talking to the CEOs primarily, some COOs as well, and I could tell you almost to a company which ones I thought would be still around at the end of COVID. And the difference was the CEOs who were leaning forward in the chair, and saying, this is an incredible opportunity right now. COVID is presenting us an opportunity to completely reshape ourselves. We're rebuilding ourselves. We see a different future for this company that we wouldn't have seen had we not been in this global pandemic. And they were excited about the future. And they were saying, this is, a challenge, but with every challenge comes opportunity. And the bigger the challenge, bigger the opportunity. I've never seen an opportunity this big. And I would be listening to that thinking, wow, that's pretty exciting, right? And then I'd have, some who would take the opposite approach, which is, hey, we got a great product and we got a great way to do in business. It's been successful for the last 40 years, and we are just sort of hunkered down right now. We know this is eventually going to end, and we're just posturing ourselves so that we're ready to, accelerate once we came out, come out of the pandemic. And not one of those companies survived, because they weren't seeing the opportunity in the challenge. So I would take a different spin on, the challenges with working with defense. I would say there's as many opportunities as there are challenges. And you got to work, you have to understand the system. You have to understand some of the checks and the balances and the 535 board members that, that have every right to have oversight over the tax dollars that are spent. Not $1 that I spent in the Air Force was mine to spend. It was mom and dad's tax money. And I, you mentioned Chairman McCain, who I'm, a huge, huge fan of. I could tell you plenty of stories of great interactions, with him. And he, by the way, raked me over the coals like he did everywhere else, but he was fair, and he was a great statesman. So I think that they've got to work within the system. They got to understand the system, but this is on industry, right? To ensure that they can do what's required to sustain their operations and then come out the back end, right? Being able to grow and take advantage of every opportunity they're given.
Let me ask you one last question, which is, how do you measure progress? We have Frank Kendall and Dave Alvin have launched the reorientation of the Air Force, the better suited for great power competition, more consolidated requirements. Again, as we discussed briefly, flatten the organizational structure. And one of the issues that we want to discuss at the APEX conference is, look, what does success look like? What does moving the needle look like? At the end of the day, what does progress look like? Because every organization is on an endless journey. The United States Air Force is never static. The decisions that are being made shape its future on a daily basis in literally millions of ways, without becoming too overly philosophical about this. What's the right approach to take as somebody who sat in this seat on how you measure progress and what it looks like?
You know, the changes that that we took on under the, when I was chief with Secretary Wilson, Secretary Barrett, you know, I had five service secretaries over 4 years, and I was lucky because they were all great, and we were able to move the ball forward. And when I walked down the hallway and I would look at the pictures of secretaries and chiefs and ask myself, okay, which were the ones that were successful at moving the ball? It was the secretaries and chiefs that understood that each of them came with a different set of authorities and responsibilities and background, and not one or the other could move the service alone. It had to be a team effort. I went back and, I remember talking to Tony McPeak and Don Rice, who had probably advanced the ball as far as anyone in terms of the complete reshaping of the Air Force.
Right.
And I asked him, so how did you do that? And what should I understand from it? They said, well, first of all, we agreed on the why, and we communicated and over-communicated that across the force. And it took all 4 years that we had together to bring these changes across the line. But we never left a conversation without explaining to anyone we were in front of why this was important. And then we talked about how we intended to do it. And then we were focused on, what the changes were. You can get that in reverse order and get that wrong, right? You can start with the what and then start talking about the how and then forget the why. And then the organization tends to go back to doing business the exact same way it did before the major changes.
Right.
Because it hasn't been infused into the culture of the organization. I give Chief Alvin and Secretary Kendall a lot of credit. I think they are doing a nice job of explaining, but if there was one thing to over-communicate, it's why, and why.
And that's the key to culture change, isn't it?
It is. I remember when we were, doing a big change of the, we were working through, squadron revitalization, some other things. I had some former chiefs that told me about 3 years into it, and they said, hey, your message, it's starting to get a little stale. You may want to think about bringing on some new things that you want to do. And I thought about it, and I went back out on my, battlefield circulation, and I came to the conclusion on my own that when I had young flight commanders and squadron commanders who were repeating back to me in their own words why we were doing the things that we were doing, then I knew that we'd achieve success because they got it. But boy, I'll tell you, that sounds good, sounds easy. It takes a lot of time and a lot of engagement. But if you want the changes to stick and you want the organization to truly improve the way it operates, man, you got to get the why right.
Sir, it is an honor and pleasure having you on the show. Thanks very much. Thank you for being so generous with your time. And you've got an open chair here anytime to join us. And I hope it's the start of many more conversations. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Pago.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. We'll be back again tomorrow with a great program focused on cyber. Be sure to tune in. Until then, hope everybody has a great day. Thanks again.